talked with Sam Smitty last week. Are you familiar with him?
Yeah.
You know, we were asking him questions about how qualifying works and then regions and stuff. So even though you're not part of a club, you can still competitively fly?
Yeah, I mean, we just don't have club flies. I can still, because you don't have to be a member of a club to fly in either the national flies or the World Cup.
Oh, okay. How do you get a judge out there? Do you have to be a member of the NBRC?
Well, the NBRC and the World Cup, they both have regions.
Okay.
And the regional director is in charge of getting a judge for the qualifying events. The fly organization obviously organizes the finals judge.
Okay. Is there a lot of competition in the region that you're at?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, we've got numerous guys that be on top, you know, any given day. Daniel Foster, you know, just a couple of them.
Okay. So then you qualify for your region, right? And then that's how you move forward to national?
Yeah. The number of qualifiers depends on how many people flew in the region. Like for the World Cup, you have to have a minimum of 7 flyers for one to earn one qualifier. With the NBRC, I think it's 10. You have to have, or it's actually kits. I think it's kits flown for the NBRC. So you have to have a certain amount of kits flown or flyers to earn one qualifier. And if you have twice as many, you can have 2, or 3 times as many, you can have 3.
And then what's the number of birds that you're flying in the kits? Is it like the 15 to 20? Is that how they do it?
Yeah, you have to fly a minimum of 15, maximum of 20. But then obviously the NBRC has 11 bird fly as well, which is different, judged and scored differently than 20 bird fly.
So how long have you been flying roller pigeons specifically?
Competitively, I flew from 2000 to 2010. Then I got out of it and went into racing. Raced for 10 years and then I got back into rollers in 2018. I've had pigeons all my life.
You've had fancy breeds and stuff like that too? Or have they always been performing pigeons?
No, I'm one of those guys that I have everything. In fact, at one point I was, because I've always had my show breeds. My show breeds are number one. And I was racing and was doing the rollers. I had all three. At one point there for a couple of years, I was competing in all three. But now it's just my show birds and the rollers. I stopped racing.
Oh, very cool. What kind of show birds you got?
I've got West of England Tumblers, which I've had since high school. I'm a superior master breeder of those.
Oh, wow.
Won many nationals, things like that. I have Old German Owls. That's my other competitive breed. And I have a few odds and ends breeds of different things. Catalan, you know. I have an aviary in the backyard that's kind of for when people come over, because if I take them out to all my loft, they don't quite understand all that. But when I have an aviary, it's full of all these pretty different breeds, you know, clean by a guy, some Catalonians, Rakovniks, everything in there, along with pheasants and cockatiels and parakeets. Well, that's, you know, like a zoo to them, and they kind of get it. But when I take them out to the pigeon lofts and they see all these pigeons, they don't quite, I don't know, it just doesn't compute with them.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a nice view right there, though, an aviary with a lot of different fancy breeds in there. It's going to look really nice.
Yeah, I've always had one of those for 25 years. Just can't sit out there in clean lofts and stare at all my other, you know, because that's a management process out there. Sometimes I just want to have a beer in the evening, you know, in the sunset. Yeah. The weather's nice, sit out there. That's when all the aviary birds get real active, you know, canaries and finches and everything gets going. And it's nice to sit out there and watch them and enjoy them without all the management hassle.
Right. No, heck yeah, that sounds real nice. In 2023, when you were flying your birds competitively, was that the year that you got that really high score?
Yeah, that was this past November, I think it was. Yeah.
What was that total? What was the score that you got?
3,175 points.
Wow. Was that a record?
Yeah.
Wow. That's
the highest score that's ever been scored in roller flying. I think prior to that, it was like 2,300, I think, somewhere in there.
Can you describe for the listeners like what that was like that day? I mean, what the weather was like? I mean, was that a pretty typical fly for your birds? Or?
I would say yes and no. I have a set management program that I put my teams through, and I try to get them to a point where they're really on and they're really hammering hard. This particular family likes to break big together, but I was actually I wasn't really happy with, because I video my birds and I study all the video and study who's doing what. And I didn't like what a couple birds were doing, and I made some feed adjustments and things like that, and added some young birds to the kit. It's mostly old birds that I fly in competition. That combination just really set them off. I mean, it was a perfect, almost perfect day for flying. It was warm, but then we had these clouds come over, and this weird little band of clouds, so in which I fly in the evenings. And it was just this perfect 65 degrees, cloud cover came over, and there was no wind, and they just went out there and just went to work and never stopped. I mean, like I said, people ask me all the time, you know, it's like, you know, do your birds work like that all the time? I'm like, well, no. I mean, I'll get 5 minutes or 10 minutes of that kind of work rate that it took to score that, you know, that high. It's seldom that never that a kit of rollers will do that for a full 20 minutes and more. It's just kind of the cycles. I mean, if you were to go around on roller flies, you kind of see the same thing. And with the first 5 minutes, they're hot, then they kind of settle down, and then they go flat for a little bit, and then they kind of get hot for a few more minutes, and then they kind of settle down again. Well, these guys just never stopped. It was pretty amazing. They just never let off the gas. You know, I had them what I call roll fit, which is their physical conditioning and their roll conditioning and their mental conditioning were all right, just perfectly in line. And then we had the luck of the gods shining down upon us that day, and everything just kind of lined up. You know, as roller flyers, 98% of the time we're flying the birds in our backyards, and we're the only ones that ever can see them.
Right.
And we've all had those days where you're like, man, why couldn't I have somebody over here today? You know, man, they're just on fire. You know, well, this was one of those days, and it just happened that we had a judge in. You know, but the best kit of pigeons that I've ever flown.
Yeah.
As far as the competition, it by far.
What is that family of birds that you flew?
They go back to the Kevin McKinney Irish Imports.
Oh, okay. How long have you been working with that family?
When I got back in rollers, this is the family that I got. My main criteria was I wanted a family of birds that flew low. I did not want birds that flew high. The only thing available to me, I wasn't going to get back into rollers, because I really hate high-flying rollers, because you can't see it. You know, they go up and, okay, game over. You can't watch them anymore if you can't see them.
Right.
Or they're too high to score. Or they go up too high and they get hit by all the predators they can see. So I want a bird to stay down low, and that was what these birds supposedly did, and they do. In fact, actually, in my opinion, they tend to fly a little too low for where I live. I live up in the woods and covered up in trees, so like when I fly them, I can barely see them half the time because of the trees.
Oh, okay. Wow, that's pretty low.
They fly treetop level. I mean, but you got to consider my trees are, big. I got 100-foot ponderosa pine.
Oh, okay. That's pretty high.
Yeah, they're big. They're big, tall trees, old trees. But they, they tend to fly right at that tree height. So it's kind of a battle to actually get them to fly a little higher than that.
So that day, I mean, they were breaking often, they were breaking deep, and they were just really clean rolls, giving you that score.
But I tell people, especially roller guys that are really hardcore into it, they all have done this. We've all done it. Or especially when we're flying our birds and they're doing pretty good, and you lay your head on the pillow at night, you're thinking about your birds, and you're just like, man, you're dreaming of that day when it's just these monster big breaks just over and over and over again. Well, this was that day, it's like I got to experience, and the people that were here got to experience that day. The main thing was, unique, was that they just never stopped. There was one period about 9 minutes in where they kind of settled down. But then, which I anticipated, that's kind of the MO. But they just went right back to work, and they just never stopped. And they actually did it for another 20 minutes after time was up. I mean, they kept hammering. But yeah, it was just, like I said, it was one of those days where their minds were all connected, and they did what they were capable of. And, we had a judge that was willing to score them. And in fact, there was several breaks that we all swore were full turns. In fact, I asked the judge about it. I'm like, just out of curiosity, I said, did you consider, or would you have considered those a full turn? He said, no. He said, both those times, there was only 18, that there was two birds that didn't fully commit. So that told me the judge was paying attention. I mean, he was watching them. And where I have the judge stand is across the road. So he sees them. He sees them more from the side. So he sees that separation. Whereas if you're standing in my backyard, when you do see them, when they come around from behind the trees, they're raining down on top of you. So it's a different visual.
Oh yeah. That way, we were talking with Sam Smitty about that. You know, these guys who are judging these flies, it takes experience to get good at being able to watch this because so many things are happening in a short period of time. You need an experienced judge out there, so that's pretty awesome. Yeah, it sounds like you just had the perfect storm. Everything was clicked and right.
It was an incredible fly. It really was fun. Now, granted, I mean, I you know, people ask me, would you have scored them that high? I go, well, one, I wasn't scoring them. I was watching them. So I have no idea what score I would have ended up with. I said, and I'm kind of a conservative judge, and it definitely would have been over 2,000 points.
Yeah.
For me, it's not about the score. I don't care what the score is as long as it's first. So
whatever it takes to get there.
It didn't need to be 3,000 points. It didn't need to be 2,000 points. It only needed to be 950 points or something like that is all it needed to be. And that's all that matters to me. Because every judge is going to score things differently. I mean, there's been numerous times where, you know, two or three different judges have scored a kit, and they all end up with different scores.
Yeah.
I mean, they may be kind of close, but the score is going to be different. Just because it's a highly subjective sport, and kind of like you were saying about with Sam Smitty, you know, he's saying the same thing. You know, it takes someone really savvy to be able to recognize what's going on. The thing that's been a challenge for a lot of judges, particularly that come over here, is a lot of them have never seen birds that break three-quarter turns over and over.
Okay.
And we're limited by our human abilities. I mean, you got all this happening in 2 to 3 seconds.
Right.
You know, so what you're doing is you're taking your best guess based on your experience of what you saw every time. I mean, that's the best you can do.
With that family of birds, and I know it's to each family, every bird reacts differently. How do you do your birds? Do you fly your birds every day? And what do you do before competition time? Do you change up your habits and feed?
Oh yeah, like my competition kids, like my old birds, they only fly maybe 2 months in the fall and 2 months in the spring, and that's it. For example, we have the World Cup coming up, and our qualifying event is going to be, I think, the second week of May. My setup is about 20 days. I'll get them back flying again about somewhere around the third week of April, depending on what the weather's like. You know, because I want to start with them all fat and all out of condition, so I can bring them into condition equally. The one variable we have this time of year is you're battling hormones, which is a really tough challenge. Whereas in the fall, we don't have that. It's just purely getting them in, bringing them into condition. So basically, I just put them on, you know, barley and wheat. We have this stuff called the curative that we used in racing to put form on the race birds. And I did the same thing with the rollers, and that burns the fat off of them pretty quickly within a week or so. Flying them at least once a day. If I can on the weekends, I'll fly them twice a day. It just depends on how I see how fast they're burning the fat off. And also, I keep my cocks and hens separate. I don't keep them together at all, ever.
Yeah.
They're always separate. Once I get to about a week, 7 to 10 days, somewhere in there, depends on what I'm seeing, then I'll fly them together. But when they come down, they're split back up again. Their boxes are next to each other, so it's pretty easy to do. But anyways, yeah, it's just bringing them into form. And once I start getting them into form, then I start go every other day. Then I'll do some back-to-back days. Then I'll not fly them for, you know, 2 or 3 days. It's kind of a yo-yo. It's what we call a yo-yo or hopscotching. You know, but it just depends on where they're at in their fly form and the roll form.
Yeah.
It's you know, there's a point that I'm trying to bring them to. Where their roll really cleans up, they start to get faster, and then at the same time you're working on getting the team to work as a unit instead of as individuals.
Right, yeah, and that's the whole thing too, you know, like you're saying, on that really good fly you had, you know, they were all clicked together, everything they did, they were all one mind.
Yeah, I mean, they were, that day was, I mean, I can picture several of the breaks right now in my mind that were just you know, I had 5, 6, 7, 8 birds in there that were, I mean, you could see were just giving it every ounce of everything they had. And what was really astonishing, and I had posted this picture the day of that fly. I posted it on the MBRC Facebook right when the birds landed. When they came down, they landed. After all that work rate, there was no birds panting. There was no birds looking tired or nothing. That's when I knew I had them just perfect. You know, I got lucky. You know, I said I should have played the lottery that day or something, but I had them at that exact state that we all strive to have them at.
Right.
And it was just absolutely amazing. I did fly them, I think, a day or two later, and they were complete crap.
Because
you could see they had all that lactic acid buildup in their muscles and everything from working so hard
right.
a couple of days before. You know, even though they looked like they were fine, they weren't fine. And again, that just kind of goes back to, yep, you know, put it all out there on the table. You know, the chances of me having a fly like that again are pretty slim. I mean, you know, the family's capable of it, but, you know, that was just really one of those days. It was just off the charts.
Yeah, and that's what's hard. You know, you hear, you know, you get your date scheduled, the judge is coming out this day to fly, and, you know, guys are, you know, like you say, you know, they're flying their birds, and some days it's just like, man, I wish somebody was here to watch. This is amazing. And some days, you know, they're not, they're hitting and they're missing, and, you know, you just got to get everything to line up.
And that's the gamble with this sport.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's so much luck in this. Weather is the number one luck thing.
Yeah.
You know, when you get your day, whatever weather you've got, that's what you got to fly them in. Some
right.
guys, unfortunately, have to fly them in the wind. Some days it'd be, you know, hot, dry, you know. Some days it'd just be one thing after another. Bluebird skies are, to me, some of the worst weather to fly in. There's no clouds in the sky. They're just not going to do that much compared to what they can do. So that, you know, luck is a lot of it. Thankfully, here where we're at, once we get into May, the weather's pretty generous, not too hot. There's still a good amount of moisture in the air because everything's still green, which makes a difference. Humidity is a big factor, in my opinion. And when I say humidity, I don't mean humidity and heat, but I mean there's moisture in the air, creates resistance on the birds, and they tend to work better, and they tend to be more frequent, as opposed to when it's, you know, really low RH, you know, like high pressure kind of weather. The birds do a lot of flying and not a lot of roll. We're fortunate in this area where the weather tends to be fairly chill, both fall and spring. So probably someplace else, you know, like say Arizona, trying to fly them in May, well, it's probably, you know, 90 or 100 degrees. Because to me, it does make a difference what the temperature is at night, because that dictates their caloric usage on the perch.
Oh yeah, that's true.
It depends on how you feed. So, you know, we'll actually still have cool nights here, so I can still be feeding them, you know, pretty generously. Whereas if it's over 70, it's 70 degrees at night, the birds, I mean, it's really hard to get a handle on the feed because they use so little
yeah.
at night. So you have to really pay attention when, or at least I do, I have to really pay attention when the nights are warm as opposed to when they're cool. Now, when they're cold, that creates a whole other ball of wax.
Right, yeah.
They're using so much, because they use so much at night. Most people don't realize how many calories they burn at night just sitting on the perch when it's 40 degrees or lower.
Yeah, no, I've never thought about that either, and especially with rollers, feed is such a big controlling factor too, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that goes into this to do it, like, on a competitive level.
Yeah.
And the reason I say this is kind of, I tell people, you know, tell people, it's like, look, if you're not doing it, you're not going to do, you might get lucky every now and then, but you're not going to do well, because there's other people that are doing it, that are paying attention to the details and managing the birds. So you have to do that as well. Granted, the birds have to have the genetic to be able to do it. You just can't pull all the right levers for birds that, you know, don't have the ingredients, right? So they have to have ingredients, and then you as a coach have to manage your team the best of your ability, and then you have to, you know, 50% of it's luck. You just got to have luck, not get hit by predators. There's a whole lot of luck things that have to go into it as well.
Yeah, that's always a bummer when someone's having a really good fly and a BOP comes through, and just wrecks it for them. I mean, you just never know.
It's unfortunate, you know, some areas are, thankfully here, like last fall was the first time ever I only lost one bird. It was wild. I mean, wow. I was loving it, you know, and I'm like, okay, any day now. And it just, for whatever reason, it never happened. And I was like, wow, this is a first. Whereas in 21, when I won the national, I lost 3 birds out of my competition kit that week, just before. I mean, just within the 5 days before the finals. And so, you know, some years are really bad and some years are decent. And this past fall was just, it's like they just did not exist up here. I was blown away. One of the reasons I believe is we have a lot of bandtail pigeons here. You know, it's a wild type pigeon. They got yellow feet and yellow beak. They live up here in these mountains, but usually they migrate down to the valley and down south for the fall and winter. Well, for whatever reason, I don't know, climate change or whatever, they didn't. And so I'd have these massive flocks of these bandtail pigeons, and I'm fairly certain that maybe the BOP was dining on them and left me alone, maybe.
Yeah. Had a full belly and got lucky on that.
Yeah, I mean, that was the one variable that I did notice that was different, was that those wild ones were still around in these huge flocks going up the mountain and coming down the mountain. You know, that was different. So maybe it was a contributing factor. I don't know. But I'll take it. You know, hopefully I get more years like that. I did try to start flying. I flew my yearling cocks pretty much through the winter on the weekends when I could. And they were left alone here until a couple of weeks ago. I started getting hammered, so I stopped flying again. Hoping everything would just kind of move on through.
What would you give as a recommendation for some new flyers, right? Some people who's had them as kind of like a backyard enjoyment thing, but kind of wanted to get into doing a competitive fly. What would you recommend for someone like that to do?
First thing to do is to get with your local club if they have one. They got to find out, find out if there's a local club. If there's not a local club, to find out find out if there's any flyers around their area. And if there are, just starting to network with them and find out when the flies are going on and go around on the flies and see how it all works. You know, meet the people, if you pay attention, you know, you'll get a better understanding of what these competition flies are all about and all the, how you go from house to house and how you see things that are different. You see different people's setups and, you know, because everybody's setup's different.
Right.
You know, and see the different kits of pigeons fly, because they're not, no two are the same. You see different families of birds and you meet different people. That's like the number one step. You know, that's a must.
Going and watching everybody fly, like you're saying, that's, you get so much. It's not just watching, a different team of birds fly. You're getting to see how they do their lofts and talk to these other guys that are flying competitively. And it's a whole bunch of information. You get the full spectrum when you get to go around on those.
Especially as a newbie, if you haven't ever done it before, it'll be eye-opening. It's just things that you're not going to see, just sitting in the backyard flying bird. And for some people, they may discover, that's a lot more work than I thought I was going to get. I don't want to get involved with that. But if they genuinely have an interest, chances are, if they're paying attention, they're going to see the birds that they thought were good in their backyard aren't as good as they thought they were.
Right.
Because they go out and actually see good kits of rollers perform. Like I said, and meet the flyers, see their setups, understand the way the process works. Like I said, going house to house. But, again, it just depends on where they're at, where they're located, if there's a local club or that particular, a part of the country has a region for the World Cup or for the NBRC fly.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You never know. I live in a really small rural community up here in the middle of nowhere. And once I kind of started meeting some of the different pigeon people up here, they knew other pigeon people. And, I had no idea. I thought I was the only guy with pigeons up here. So just put it out there. You never know.
They're far away from everybody. And the closest flyer to me is about 40 minutes.
Okay.
Down the hill, the closest roller flyer to me, and I'm sure there's backyard guys. I know there's a guy in town who has those English mag tumblers. That he just has them. He flies them down there. And he doesn't compete or even go around on the flies. it's funny because my feed store here in town, you know, it's a rural town, the whole rural Placerville, and they go through a lot of pigeon feed. And I always ask them, like, who's buying all this pigeon feed? You know, where's the pigeon guys at? She said, there's a lot of people that just have them, you know, just have them because they have them.
That's funny. I've had that exact same conversation with our feed store in town. You guys got pigeon feed? Oh, yeah. So I'm not the only one buying it?
Yeah, there's a lot, you know, I've, you know, eventually met people. They just have some, you know, they just, because they enjoy them and whatever. They don't, like, again, you know, they don't network. They don't Facebook. They don't.
Yeah.
They don't go to shows or, you know, anything like that.
Well, we're coming up against the clock here, but Brian, thanks for coming on and talking with the listeners and giving us some advice and stuff. And hey, good luck. Is it in May that you're doing the World Cup fly or the National fly?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, good luck with that. I hope you can break your record again.
I don't think that'll ever happen, but I'll definitely strive for it.
There you go. Awesome. Thank you, Brian.
All right. Well, you have a good day.